Hello, this is William Fink, and this is Christogenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, December 28th, 2018, probably our last podcast of this year. And we are going to do something a little different this evening. Originally, I thought about presenting Clifton Emmaheiser's short paper, Diverse Seed Defiles Families, along with my own commentary, of course. We may present that essay here in mid-January instead, since while I began preparing for that, a Christogenia Forum member had enlightened me to a book by Dr. John Van Every titled On Negroes and Negro Slavery, which was a defense of the institution of slavery in the South by a medical doctor from New York, of all places. Looking into this book, I saw that Wikipedia and other sources nearly ridicule Van Every, yet his book was actually cited in a famous Britannica article on Negroes. It was cited in the bibliography, which expressed many views shared by so-called rednecks and racists of today. It seems like 100 years ago, our view of the Negro was actually quite popular among anthropologists, ethnologists, and other academics. This is actually an extension of things that both Clifton Emmaheiser and myself had said as I presented his series of papers identifying the beast of the field, where we cited similar sentiments as they were expressed by 19th century geologist Alexander Winchell, and elsewhere where I had mentioned men such as Alexander Winchell, along with Professor Charles Carroll and his book, The Negro, A Beast, or In the Image of God, in my essay on the role of faith in a successful insurgency, movement, or community. So this is my endeavor to examine that phenomenon to a greater extent. That phenomenon of those opinions held by educated men in the 19th century. So this is the scientific view of the Negro before the age of political correctness, part one, because I hope to continue this probably at various or diverse times throughout the year 2019. This presentation, which may well become at least an occasional series, will endeavor to demonstrate that many mainstream writers and academics of the 19th and early 20th centuries, educated men who could not merely be dismissed as rednecks or racists, had correctly considered the Negro more as a beast than as a person, and certainly not as an entity which deserved a right to stand alongside white men as an equal peer in a civilized society. Of course, we certainly agree with that, not because we merely hate Negroes, but because we have observed their behavior. We have judged their fruits. And we realize that they are far more an impediment to the function of society than they have ever been a benefit. They have been far more a destructive agent than they shall ever be a constructive asset. We believe that the evidence of the last 100 years demonstrates that as a race, Negroes should have been left separated to dwell in their aboriginal state, and the only sound alternative was to leave them as non-citizens and slaves. Today, after nearly a century of quote-unquote equality, our cities are destroyed, our educational institutions have been debased with mediocrity, morals and ethics have become relative, and our arts are now mostly decadent exhibitions of savage concupiscence. We have become an English-speaking Africa decorated with European technology and a few still white faces. White faces which are slowly coerced into awarding the Negro with ever-increasing benefits which stand as bribes so that they would maintain a facade of civility. We can see the results of Negro emancipation and legislated political equality having actually experienced the phenomenon. However, one man who tried to warn the world of its consequences in advance was a medical doctor named John H. Van Every, who lived from 1814 to 1896. He was also the editor and proprietor of a newspaper called the Weekly Day Book, a democratic newspaper, and a son of the founder of the city of Rochester, a city on Lake Ontario in New York State. He also published several books on race relations and the character of the Negro, for which he used his own publishing company, Van Every Horton and Company. His conclusions concerning the Negro led him to become a defender of the institution of slavery and a defender of the cause of the Old South. He is slandered by mainstream sources today, even in spite of the fact that many of his conclusions have been proven by the events of history subsequent to the war between the states. Here is the preface to his book, Negroes and Negro Slavery, the first, an inferior race, the later, its normal condition, which was published in its second edition in 1861, and we will present the entire preface. Since the first edition of this work was issued, startling and deplorable events have occurred. I don't know when that first edition was, presumably in the late 1850s. The great anti-slavery delusion that originated with European monarchists more than 50 years ago, after the French Revolution, has culminated in disunion and civil war, as its authors always predicted it would, and he considered that a startling and deplorable event. A party strongly imbued with the false theories and absurd assumptions of British writers and abolition societies is in possession of the federal government, which it stands pledged to use to reduce its assumptions to practice. It holds that the Negro, excepting color, is a man like themselves and naturally entitled to the same liberty, that to deny him this liberty is to enslave him, that therefore Southern society is wrong and should be revolutionized, and it avows it to be its mission to accomplish this, to institute a policy that shall finally abolish or destroy the supremacy of the white man and secure the impartial freedom for Negroes. I must add that to destroy the supremacy of the white man would include having to destroy the white man himself. Because regardless of the odds, and regardless of the conditions in society, the white man will always be superior by nature of his biology. That's my assertion. Returning to Van Every. To this, the South replies that this government was created for white men alone, and their posterity, as declared in the preamble to the Constitution, that the Supreme Court has recently declared the same great truth, that seizing the government by a mere sectional vote and placing it in distinct conflict with the social order of the South, with the avowed purpose of penning up its Negro population in order to bring about someday the extinction or overthrow of the existing condition, is therefore an overthrow of the Constitution. That the object avowed necessarily involves their future destruction, the future destruction of Southern white men. And to save themselves from the wild delusion and malignant fanaticism of the North, they are forced, in self-defense, to withdraw from the Union hitherto or until this hostile and dangerous party entered the field, so beneficial to all sections of the country. Now, we do not really agree that the war between the states was all about slavery, but slavery was certainly used as a dividing issue to enlist support of Northerners for the war, and that was especially true among the Puritans of New England and the Quakers of Pennsylvania. Returning to Van Every, so stands the case between the sections. If the anti-slavery party was based on truth, if the Negro, excepting color, was a man like ourselves, if social subordination of this Negro was wrong, and the 4 millions of these people at the South entitled to the same liberty as ourselves, and if the men who made this government designed it to include the inferior races of this continent, and it were really beneficial to equalize and fraternize with these Negroes, then, though it may be doubted, if using the common government to bring it about were proper, and the end in view would be so beneficial, and such a transcendent act of justice to these assumed slaves, that all honest, earnest, and patriotic citizens should promptly sustain the party now striving to accomplish it. But, on the contrary, if this party is based on a stupendous falsehood, if the Negro is a different and inferior being, and in his normal condition at the South, and if the men who made this government designed it for white men alone, then the length and breadth and width and depth of the anti-slavery delusion and the crime of the anti-slavery party, which has broken up the Union in a blind crusade after Negro freedom, will be fully comprehended by the American people. The whole mighty question, therefore, with all its vast and boundless consequences, hinges on the apparently simple question of fact. Is the Negro, excepting color, a man like ourselves, and therefore naturally entitled to the same liberty? In the inside cover to this book, in the title page was a quote from Thomas Jefferson, which had doubted the equality of the Negro on that same basis. It began with a quotation. It opened with a quotation from Thomas Jefferson stating, "To our reproach it must be said that, though for a century and a half we have had under our eyes the races of black and of red men, they have never yet been viewed by us as subjects of natural history from an objective, scientific viewpoint. I advance it, therefore, as a suspicion only that the blacks, whether originally a different race, or made distinct by time and circumstances, are inferior to the whites in the endowments of both mind and body." That was Thomas Jefferson's expression in his Notes on Virginia. And he was certainly correct, even though that idea, that concept, is ridiculed today. Continuing with John Van Embry, "It is absolutely certain that neither the liberty, the rights, nor the interests of one single northern citizen is involved. Nothing whatever but a blind and foolish theory of Negro slavery, which is attempted to be forced on the South. If the people of the two great sections of the country could change places, the vast anti-slavery delusion would be exploded in 60 days. But as this is impossible, the next best thing is to explain the actual condition of things in the South to the northern mind. This great work the author has undertaken, not to defend an imaginary slavery, for it needs no defense, but to explain the social order, to demonstrate to the senses, as well as the reason, that the Negro is a different and subordinate being, and in his normal condition at the South," his normal condition being slavery, "and thus to show the enormous and fathomless folly, crime, and impiety wrapped up in the great anti-slavery delusion of the day. The former edition of this work," his first edition, "was put to press so hurriedly that it contained many errors, but the present one has been carefully revised, and, moreover, the introductory chapter has been rewritten in order to present a more distinct history of the origin and progress of the great British anti-slavery imposture, which is now working out its legitimate and designed purpose in the destruction of the American Union." And we have always said that the abolitionist movement in America was financed and promoted principally by the Rothschilds. Continuing with Van Embry, "In conclusion, the author begs to say that mere literary display or fine writing is with him quite a subordinate consideration. He only desires to be understood, and that the grand and momentous truths described in his book shall be clearly comprehended by the masses, with the confident assurance that when they come to understand that their own liberty, welfare, and prosperity are all hazarded in a blind crusade after that which, could it be accomplished, would be the greatest calamity ever inflicted on a civilized people," meaning their equalization with Negroes, the emancipation of Negroes, the causeless and senseless but frightful sectional conflict now raging will be speedily terminated by the universal uprising of the northern masses in favor of a government of white men and union with the South. And that was his hope, but sadly it didn't happen. And it didn't happen because it wasn't until the 1960s that a stupidified, a dumbed-down white society in the North was subjected to Negro presence in any great degree. And I can say from experience that even to this very day, most of the whites in the North are not truly familiar with the decadence in northern cities and the negative effect that the Negro has had on white civilization in the North. Most rural whites still don't know much about Negroes. Of course, the preamble to the American Constitution is indeed ignored to this very day. The preamble states explicitly that the rights, privileges, benefits, enjoyment of the new nation under this Constitution were for the authors and their posterity. So there should be no doubt that it was overthrown in 1861, and every act of government since then has, in reality, been an act of tyranny. But that is another subject separate from our purposes here. Van Every's writings were Christian in nature, and he certainly seemed to have faith in the English Bible. But he soundly rejected what he called monogenism, or the belief in a single genesis for all races. We also reject that belief, as it is certainly not what the Bible teaches. Van Every correctly believed that Negroes had an origin other than the patriarch and race of Adam. The Wikipedia article for Van Every states in part that his thought, which lacked significant scientific evidence even for the time, emphasized the inferiority of black people to white people, defended slavery as practiced in the United States, and attacked abolitionism. But here we must ask, did Van Every's thought really lack scientific evidence even for the time? Or is Wikipedia merely manufacturing or repeating propaganda? If we can find a reputable source which upheld Van Every's findings on a scientific basis, then Wikipedia is willfully misrepresenting the truth of the matter. Furthermore, if we can find such a reputable source which upheld Van Every's conclusions, then we must admit that the claims of recent science are radically different than they were in past decades, and we should inquire as to why science has changed if, in the first place, it was based on quantifiable observation. And we are only picking on Wikipedia here because it is a source at hand and representative. It is truly representative of modern mainstream thinking as it is portrayed in the media. So indeed, we have found such a source. In the article for The Negro, which is found in the 9th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Here we shall see that Van Every's findings were indeed accepted as scientific, even for the time. And not only for the time when he published his books, but for 50 years after it was published. So here we are going to present this article nearly in its entirety. But first, this is, in part, what Wikipedia says of the Encyclopedia Britannica itself. The Britannica is the oldest English language encyclopedia still in production. It was first published between 1768 and 1771 in the Scottish capital of Edinburgh as 3 volumes. The encyclopedia grew in size. The second edition was 10 volumes, and by its 4th edition, 1801 to 1810, it had expanded to 20 volumes. Its rising stature as a scholarly work helped recruit eminent contributors, and the 9th and 11th editions, the 9th edition having been published from 1875 to 1879, and the 11th edition in 1911, the 9th and 11th editions are landmark encyclopedias for scholarship and literary style. Thanks to our dear friend, Clifton Emmeheiser, we have copies of both the 9th and 11th editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica on our bookshelves. And actually, the 9th edition, which took, according to Wikipedia, 14 or 15 years to publish, is materially superior. It's printed and bound with much better materials than the 11th edition, which took only a year to publish and which is literally falling apart on those bookshelves. Seeing that Wikipedia had called the 9th edition of Britannica a landmark encyclopedia for scholarship and literary style, how can it be denied that this is not only a viable, but even an authoritative source for what is scientific for its time? Indeed, by their own standards, by their own words, it must be accepted as such a source. And once it is seen that John Van Every was credited in the bibliography of the Encyclopedia Britannica article for the Negro, then Wikipedia's slander of Van Every becomes evident for what it is, an attempt to discredit a legitimate scientific view of the 19th century for obvious modern political reasons. Van Every was credited in the bibliography for this article, and the content of the article supports Van Every's conclusions, by which his views have full vindication as being scientifically valid. The following article on a Negro, which we will present almost completely, is from volume 17 of the Encyclopedia Britannica, the 9th edition, published in 1894. We shall also have it available here for inspection in PDF format when we post this presentation at Christigenia this evening. We shall not present the entire article for the podcast, but it is found, or it will be found, in its entirety in the written version, which shall accompany the podcast. We're only skipping certain parts which are really meaningless to our purpose here, the long lists of the various tribes, Negro tribes in Africa, would simply be tedious to include with the podcast. Footnotes here have been converted to endnotes, and they will also be omitted from the podcast, but they will be included in our written version. Negro, the Spanish and Italian negro, from the Latin niger, meaning black, niger, or perhaps nigger. In anthropology, Negro designates the distinctly dark, as opposed to the fair, yellow, and brown varieties of mankind. In this, its widest sense, it embraces all of the dark races, whose original home are the intertropical and subtropical regions of the Eastern Hemisphere, stretching roughly from Senegambia, what we know as Senegal and Gambia, West Africa, to the Fiji Archipelago, Pacific Ocean, west and east, and lying north and south between the extreme parallels of the Philippines and Tasmania. So Malaysians, Filipinos, all of these are considered in the 19th century to belong to the Negro races. The Negro domain thus originally comprised all Africa south of the Sahara, India south of the Indo-Gangetic Plains, Malaysia and the greater part of Australasia. And outside of the scope of this particular article, it can be demonstrated from other 19th century anthropologists that Negroes were being traded by Arabs for 1,000 years before the 18th century, as far east as the Philippines. Our article continues. But this domain has, since prehistoric times, been intruded upon in the east, mainly by peoples of the yellow mongoloid, in the west, mainly by peoples of the fair Caucasic stock. Caucasic stands for Caucasian here, as we would write today. During the early and middle tertiary epochs, it appears to have been gradually broken into two great divisions, speaking of the Negro race as a whole. By the subsidence of lands, some suppose, which are now flooded by the waters of the Indian Ocean, and to which the English lawyer and zoologist Philip Sclater has given the name of Lemuria, the lost continent of Mu, which is basically mythical. To these two great eastern and western geographic divisions now correspond the two great ethnical divisions of the Negro stock, the Papuan or Melanesian of Malaysia and Australasia, and the Negro proper of the African mainland. During the long ages that have elapsed since this separation, the two branches, if originally one, and they doubt that as well, or question that as well, have had time under diverse outward conditions to become differentiated into two sufficiently marked physical types, so that on strictly anthropological as well as geographical grounds, it becomes convenient to deal separately with the Papuan and African divisions of the Negro family. The present article is confined to the latter. This article on a Negro is confined to the African Negro. For the Papuans, see the Britannica article for New Guinea, which we won't see here, and which we are not compelled to provide. Of course, we do not necessarily believe that Lemuria existed as such, but this article presents it as one possible explanation for the distribution of Negroes across the areas where they were originally found by European explorers. It does not mention, as we have, the Arab trading of Negroes at a very early time as another possible source for the distribution of Negroes across that area. Continuing with Britannica, Sudan, the fertile zone stretching from the Sahara towards the equator nearly across the continent, is usually regarded as the true home of the African Negro. But according to the views recently advanced by Lepsius, and we'll get to him in a moment, Sudan is rather an intermediate or mixed domain lying between the two Hamitic, after the biblical tribe of Ham, and Negro ethnical groups, which have respectively occupied northern and southern Africa from the remotest times. Certainly none of the chief native races in Sudan, Mandingo, Mandingo, Jolof, Tukulor, or Tukulur in the west, Kanembu, Hausa, Kanuri in the center, Maba in Wadae, Nuba in the Nile Valley, least of all the Fulas of the Chad and Niger basins, can be considered as of pure Negro descent. But the same phenomenon of intermixture is presented in the strictly equatorial and south equatorial regions, where the Fans of the Ogowe Basin, the Zande, who are also referred to as Niamniam, Bongo, Bari, and Upper Nilotic tribes, the Waganda of the Victoria Nyanza of the extreme east, the Zulu Kafirs of the extreme south, are all of Negroid and even sub-Negroid, rather than of strictly Negro lineage. They're basically saying that they're all race mixed with portions of other races. Hence, the same argument would exclude Sudan, would also exclude the greater part of southern Africa, and we should have to look to the hypothetical Lemuria, or other now submerged lands, for the cradle of the Negro stock. Practically, however, the whole of Africa south of the Sahara must be taken as the original habitat of the race, which is there almost everywhere still found in compact masses, although rarely, perhaps, absolutely free from foreign intermixture. This Carl Richard Lepsius, who lived from 1810 to 1884, was a Prussian Egyptologist and linguist, and is considered a pioneer of modern archaeology. Notice the use of the biblical term, Hamites, or Hamitic, and the view of them as being distinct from Negroes. In the overall context of this article, it is evident that both Hamites and Shemites were considered by the authors to be Caucasian, and to have been groups which were distinct from the Negroes. This also supports Van Evry's rejection of monogenism or monogenism, which is the ridiculous idea that all hominids came from Adam. Nevertheless, the article comprises biblical language and positions. It compromises biblical language and positions with a belief in the concept of evolution, or at least a profession of the concept of evolution, a combination which was not uncommon for the time. Anthropologists of the 19th century commonly spoke in biblical terms concerning the races of man, and especially the white race, while mixing that with a profession of evolutionary concepts, something that I believe we should certainly reject. Continuing with Britannica, but wherever found in a comparatively pure state, as on the coast of Guinea, in the Gabon, along the lower Zambezi, a river, and in the Benue and Shari basins, other rivers, the African aborigines present almost a greater uniformity of physical and moral type than any of the other great divisions of mankind, not, as we shall see, that they have morals, but that they have the same moral type. By the nearly unanimous consent of anthropologists, this type occupies, at the same time, the lowest position in the evolutionary scale, thus affording the best material for the comparative study of the highest anthropoids and the human species. And here the Negro is rather objectively considered to be one of the highest anthropoids, as distinct from the human species. The chief points in which the Negro either approaches the quadrumana, the bipeds, or the four-footed animals, or differs most from his own congeners, which are other anthropoids, a category which can include apes and other primates, as well as men, are what distinguishes the Negro. The chief points in which the Negro either approaches the four-footed animals or differs most from other two-footed animals are the first, the abnormal length of the arm, which in the erect position sometimes reaches the knee pan, and which on an average exceeds that of the Caucasian by about 2 inches. And two, and I think there's 13 points in this list, prognathism, or the projection of the jaws, having an index number of facial angle about 70 as compared with the Caucasian 82. And three, the weight of the brain as indicating cranial capacity, 35 ounces, where in the highest gorilla it is 20 ounces, and in the average European, 45 ounces. And four, a full black eye with black iris and yellowish sclerotic coat, a very marked feature. Yellow, they don't really have whites to their eyes, they have yellow eyes. Short, flat, snub nose, deeply depressed at the base or frontal suture, broad at the extremity, with dilated nostrils and a concave ridge. And six, thick protruding lips, plainly showing the inner red surface. And seven, very large zygomatic arches, the zygomatic arches being the arches on the front of the skull which create the cheekbones, high and prominent cheekbones. And eight, an exceedingly thick cranium, enabling the Negro to butt with the head and resist blows which would inevitably break any ordinary European skull. And nine, correspondingly weak lower limbs, terminating in a broad flat foot with low instep, divergent and somewhat prehensile great toe and heel projecting backwards, which they call lark heel. And 10, a complexion deep brown or blackish, and in some cases even distinctly black, due not to any special pigment, as is often supposed, but merely to the greater abundance of the color matter in the Malpighian mucous membrane between the inner or true skin and the epidermis or scarf skin. And 11, Short black hair, eccentrically elliptical or almost flat in section, and distinctly woolly, not merely frizzly, as British doctor and anthropologist James Cowles Pritchard supposed on insufficient evidence. And 12. Thick epidermis, and there's a footnote explaining that and citing the sources. Thick epidermis, cool, soft, and velvety to the touch, mostly hairless, and emitting a peculiar rancid odor, compared by German physician Franz Ignaz Pruner, or Pruner Bay, as he's called, to that of the buck goat. Pruner Bay was a German physician who spent considerable time in Egypt. And 13. Frame of medium height, thrown somewhat out of the perpendicular by the shape of the pelvis, the spine, the backward projection of the head, and the whole anatomical structure. And 14, I'm sorry, there were 14 of these. The cranial sutures, which close much earlier in the Negro than in other races. To this, premature ossification of the skull, preventing all further development of the brain. Many pathologists have attributed the inherent mental inferiority of the blacks, an inferiority which is even more marked than their physical differences. Nearly all observers admit that the Negro child is, on the whole, quite as intelligent as those of other human races, but that on arriving at puberty, all further progress seems to be arrested. No one has more carefully studied this point than the Italian Filippo Manetta in his book The Negro Race in Its Wild State, who during a long residence on the plantations of the southern states of America had noted that the Negro children were sharp, intelligent, and full of vivacity. But on approaching the adult period, a gradual change set in. The intellect seemed to become clouded, animation giving place to a sort of lethargy, briskness yielding to indolence. We must necessarily suppose that the development of the Negro and white proceeds on different lines. With the latter, the volume of the brain grows with the expansion of the brain pan. In the former, meaning the Negro, the growth of the brain is, on the contrary, arrested by the premature closing of the cranial sutures and lateral pressure on the frontal bone. The Jew Stephen Jay Gould made a career at Harvard, issuing refutations of these findings, basically inventing conspiracy theories and accusing anthropologists and other scholars of the 19th century of lying and manufacturing data. And I've actually found statements along those lines in a book called The Languages of Psyche. In part 4 of that book, subtitled Medicine, Racism, Antisemitism, A Dimension of Enlightenment Culture. However, the author's conclusions are different from our own. Continuing with Britannica, it must at the same time be confessed that the question of the mental temperament of the Negro has been greatly complicated by the partisanship of interested advocates on either side. In other words, there's propaganda coming from pro-Negroes and more objective anthropologists. I say that because none of these anthropologists had any evident axe to grind and nothing to gain by purposely disparaging Negroes. What was their gain? Especially for the Germans and for the post-war between the states Americans. They had nothing to gain. The British anthropologists had nothing to gain by misrepresenting the facts. Not that I could possibly tell. If you want to accuse somebody of a crime, you have to prove the facts of the crime and also deduce the possible motive. I mean, I just don't see it. I'm sorry, I'll continue because I'm just rambling. It must be at the same time confessed that the question of the mental temperament of the Negro has been greatly complicated by the partisanship of interested advocates on either side. But for this disturbing element, it would perhaps be readily admitted that the mental are at least as marked as the physical differences between the dark and other races, and as both are the gradual outcome of external conditions fixed by heredity, it follows that the attempt to suddenly transform the Negro mind by foreign culture must be, as it has proved to be, as futile as the attempt would be to suddenly transform his physical type. On his moral status, even when removed from the old associations and brought directly under more favorable influences, a lurid light is cast by the report of the Reverend Dr. Tucker at the American Church Congress for 1883 on the present condition of the black communities in the southern states. And here is the one footnote which I will include with this presentation, where Reverend Dr. Tucker is cited to have said, "I know of whole neighborhoods where there is not one single Negro couple, whether legally married or not, who are faithful to each other beyond a few weeks. In the midst of a prayer meeting, I have known Negroes stealing from each other, and on the way home, they will rob any hen roost that lies conveniently at hand. The most pious Negro that I know is confined in a penitentiary for an atrocious murder, and he persists in saying that he can see no offense against God in his crime, although he acknowledges an offense against man. Mention is further made of Negro missionaries guilty of the grossest immorality, living in open concubinage, addicted to thieving, lying, and every imaginary crime." Sounds like Jesse Jackson and Martin Luther King Jr. "Yet all earnest and successful preachers and wholly unconscious of hypocrisy. Their sins, universally known, did not diminish their influence with their race." He may as well have been talking about Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and Martin Luther King Jr., except that this is 100 years before those men came into their careers. And speaking of their sins, and members of their own race, it was impossible to doubt their absolute sincerity. The article then states in response to that, "A much darker picture is presented by the independent Negro commonwealths of Haiti. For 80 years, the scene of almost uninterrupted fratricidal strife. The entire baby's daddy and single mother phenomenon, which we have today, informs us that Reverend Tucker was correct, and his remarks fully justified by history. The fact, the absolute fact, that in our modern cities at this very moment, Negroes are slaughtering one another in drive-by shootings and other similar incidences justifies the quantification of Negro character expressed in this article at this point, without a doubt. Continuing with Britannica, it is more correct to say of the Negro that he is non-moral rather than immoral. All the social institutions are at the same low level, and throughout the historic period seem to have made no perceptible advance except under the stimulus of foreign, and in recent time notably of Mohammedan, influences. And I don't know if having sex with little boys and goats is a positive influence, but that's the opinion of the author of the article on a Negro in Encyclopedia Britannica. Religion is a system of pure fetishism and worship of ancestry associated with such sanguinary rites as the quote-unquote customs of Dahomey and Ashanti, and a universal belief in sorcery. Slavery continues everywhere to prevail, speaking of the Negroes in Africa, both as a local institution and a branch of the export trade, where it is not checked by European governments. Much of the surplus population, not thus carried off, probably finds its way to the shambles, that's a British word for butcher shops, the shambles of the native states in the Middle Congo Basin and other parts where cannibalism is practiced and where human flesh appears to be sold in the open marketplace. It was actually news articles indicating that this is still going on in rather recent times. I know I have one posted somewhere at Christigenia, or I just couldn't find it in time for this presentation. During its voyage down the Congo, the Stanley expedition was attacked at many points for the avowed purpose of procuring a fresh supply of human food. And from other incidents of modern exploration, cannibalism would seem to prevail very generally in the little-known equatorial regions of the interior. Political institutions are in a rudimentary state, and where a higher system has been imposed or adopted from the whites, as in Liberia, it does not appear to have materially contributed to the improvement of the race. The great bulk of the natives are still in the tribal condition, while in the kingdoms that have been founded in Guinea and elsewhere, the authority of the sovereign is everywhere absolute, and its exercise often marked by the most wanton and atrocious cruelty. The largest and most powerful native state is that of Ulunda, whose present Muata Yanvo, or ruler, is the 14th in descent from the founder of the dynasty. When visited in 1879 by Dr. Buckner, this potentate, to impress his guest with his power, caused one of his subjects to assume the part of a chief just arrived from a remote province of the empire. The sham cortege of soldiers and women advanced to the throne, all thickly plastered with mud from head to foot, and the chief, the sham pretend chief, approaching on all fours, deliberately rolled himself in sand at His Majesty's feet, this being a reenactment. The administration of justice is regulated not by any sense of right or wrong, but by the caprice of the king, who is himself often in the power of the Navumbula, or witch detector. Beyond what has been acquired from without, of letters there is absolutely no knowledge, unless an exception be made in favor of the invention or adaptation of a rude syllabic system some years ago by a native of the Vei tribe, V-E-I, I'll pronounce that Vei. Hence, literature is purely oral and limited to a few tribal legends, some folklore, proverbs, and songs of the simplest kind. The arts also are exclusively of an industrial character and restricted mainly to coarse weaving, pottery, the smelting and working of metals, chiefly copper and iron, agriculture and grazing. Architecture has no existence, nor are there any monumental ruins or stone structures of any sort in the whole of Negroland, except those erected in Sudan under Hamitic and Semitic influences. No full-blood Negro has ever been distinguished as a man of science, a poet or an artist, and the fundamental equality claimed for him by ignorant philanthropists is belied by the whole history of the race throughout the historic period. And I'm sure that if we had insight into the prehistoric period, we would find that they obtained metallurgy and other knowledge, such as coarse weaving and pottery, from outside sources as well. That may never be proven, but it should be completely evident, since the Negro has not since, on his own, developed any other arts or sciences. Returning to Britannica. On the other hand, the native languages, all of which belong to the agglutinating order, are often very highly developed, and the Bantu group especially is characterized by an intricacy of structure and an alliterative phonetic system of an exceedingly delicate type. From the wide range of this Bantu speech, which occupies all the southern half of the continent except the Hottentot and Bushman territory in the extreme southwest, Lepsius, the German linguist, Lepsius concludes that it is the original language of the Negro race, and that the numerous linguistic groups of Sudan are merely scattered fragments of that speech or of the Hamitic intruding from the north. Thus has been developed his theory of the two ethnical and linguistic stocks, originally in exclusive possession of North and South Africa, and gradually amalgamating in the now diversified intermediate zone of Sudan. But this theory cannot be accepted as at all adequate to explain the present conditions in those regions. It is not by any means certain that the Bantu itself was originally a Negro language at all. There seems, moreover, to be good reason for believing that its present diffusion over South Africa dates from comparatively recent times, and that it is due to the intrusion of foreign conquerors penetrating from the northeast up the Nile Valley and through the region of the Great Lakes into the Congo and Zambezi basins. Nor is it possible to regard the Mandingo, Vei, Hausa, Fula, and many other Sudanese tongues as fragments or offshoots of Bantu, from which they differ as fundamentally as they do from each other. To Dr. Gustav Nachtigal, a German surgeon, explorer, author, and diplomat, is due the recent discovery or determination of another independent and widespread linguistic family, which had its original home amongst the Hamitic Teda or northern Tubus of the eastern Sahara, and which, gradually spreading southwards, has been imposed through the Dasa or southern Tubus on the Kanembu and Kinuri of Lake Chad, the Bela of Wanyanga and the Zoghawa of Darfur, and other Negro or Negroid peoples of central and eastern Sudan. The whole of Sudan, or more correctly, the whole of Central Africa, between the equator and the Sahara, is in fact a region of linguistic confusion, such as is elsewhere found only in Caucasia, Melanesia, the Annamese Highlands, and some parts of America. Several radically distinct stock languages have already been determined, especially in Guinea, Senegambia, and the Chad Basin, but many more are known to be current in Adamawa, Bornu, Baghermi, Wade, Darfur, the White Nile Valley, while others will doubtless be revealed by future exploration of the lands watered by the Well, Aruwimi, Mangala, and other streams flowing either to the Nile, the Congo, or the Shari. Most of them may be properly designated as strictly Negro tongues. But in the north, that is, along the skirt of the Sahara, and in the east, that is, in the Blue Nile and Atbara basins, in Kaffa, Gala, and Somaliland, the current speech is mainly Caucasic, meaning that their language had Caucasian origins. And here also the populations are mainly Negroid and sub-Negroid rather than of pure Negro descent. And we can account for that in not too distant history. The Caucasic speech again is represented by Hamitic, Tubu, and Semitic groups, all intruders in this Negro domain from prehistoric times, except the Semitic Arabic, which dates only from the introduction of Islam. In attempting a complete, however brief, survey of this vast ethnical and linguistic area, account must also be taken of other disturbing elements within the area itself, which are of unknown origin and whose actual relations to the surrounding Negro masses are still involved in much obscurity. Conspicuous amongst them are the Nubas of the Middle Nile, apparently intermediate between the true Negro and the Egyptian Hamite, and we would say that they are certainly ancient white Egyptians and ancient white Ethiopians mingled with black blood. The Fulas from the 3rd millennium BC, or starting there at least, the Fulas of Central and West Sudan, who, although now much mixed, seem to have been originally distinct both from the Negro and the Hamite. The Fans, who have in recent times reached the west coast just above the equator, and who are also clearly a non-Negro race. Lastly, the dwarfish Akas, Obongos, and others, who appear to be scattered over the whole of the continent south of 10 degrees north latitude. Many, perhaps the majority, of the Bantu-speaking southern races, the Waswahili of the Zanzibar coast, the Waganda, and others of the great lacustrine region, Zulu Kafirs of the southeast, Marutsi of the Zambezi, Ovambos of the southwest coast, are also variously affected by foreign elements, some no doubt either Arab or Hamitic Gala penetrating from the northeast, but others drawn from now long forgotten sources. Thus, the popular idea that Negroland represents a homogeneous ethnical field must be dismissed as absolutely erroneous. It will be safer to say that while the Negro strain is here, everywhere conspicuously present, it has been repeatedly crossed and recrossed with diverse interminglings, which began with the first appearance of the Hamite on African soil, and which have been continued from that vastly remote epoch down to the present time. I think they're confusing Hamites with what we would call fallen angels, but that's another story. So our authors did understand that Hamites and Semites were both Caucasic, even if they did not realize, or at least admit, that they were originally and completely of the European variety of Caucasian, and that today's specimens are all bastards. They also understood that Negroes had a separate origin, and that these whites in Africa were mixing with Negroes at a very early time, and also that at least most Negroes were mixed in this manner. Continuing with Britannica. From the subjoined rough scheme of classification of the chief Negro and Negroid races and languages are excluded the above-mentioned Caucasic-speaking Hamites and Semites, who hem in the Negro zone proper by a mighty ethnical barrier stretching almost continuously from the Senegal River through the Sahara, Abyssinia, and Galiland to the east coast at the equator. From it are also omitted the Hovas, Sakalavas, Betsimisarakas, and other peoples of Madagascar, all of Malagasy or Malayo-Polynesian speech, as well as the Bojismen and Hottentot groups of the extreme southwest, as lying beyond the scope of the present survey. Now, at this point, our article lists all of the tribes of Negroes recognized by its sources, which we shall omit in the audio presentation of the article. There would be no point in just going through a whole list of 200 Negro tribes, which would, with names which would even be difficult for me to pronounce. And then after listing all of the various tribes of Negroes and describing their locations, our article concludes, "The total population is vaguely estimated at 130 million, to which," now this is 1886, I believe, "to which must be added probably about," I'm sorry, 1894, I believe, "to which must be added probably about 20 million full-blood and half-caste Negroes settled either as slaves or the descendants of slaves in various parts of the world, but chiefly in tropical and subtropical America. Owing to their peculiar qualities, great muscular development, and power of endurance in hot and moist lands, combined with a remarkable absence of personal self-respect, the African populations have, from the remotest times, supplied a chief material to the slave markets of the Old and New World. For thousands of years, an incessant stream of black blood has been directed from the interior coast to the east coast, and thence to Madagascar, Arabia, Persia, and even India, and we would say even as far east as the Philippines and Southeast Asia, as we had previously mentioned, or down the Nile to Egypt and Asia Minor, or across the Sahara to the Barbary States, modern Libya and those environs. Since the discovery of America, hundreds of thousands have in the same way been shipped from the West Coast for the West Indies, New Spain, the British and French plantations, and Brazil. Speaking generally, this black element has not amalgamated with the populations of the Eastern Hemisphere and has consequently left few traces of its presence anywhere except in Madagascar, where there may possibly have been an indigenous Negro people before the arrival of the intruding Hovas and other Malay tribes. Our editor takes for granted that the Hemitic race was originally brown, which is not true. They have indeed mingled with the aboriginal races of the Eastern Hemisphere, just not in times which were observable to Europeans. Nevertheless, a strain of Negro blood is apparent, not only amongst the Tuaregs and especially the Tibus of the Sahara, but also in Morocco, South Algeria, Egypt, the low-lying Pohama of the West Arabian seaboard, Makran, and even here and there along the coast of Malabar and Ceylon. But no statistics are anywhere here available which might throw some light on the proportion of blacks to the surrounding populations. We read that there may be as many as 100,000 in Morocco, a large number amongst the Berbers of Ouargla, South Algeria, and Tripoli, and so on. It is also evident that a decided majority of the inhabitants of Madagascar must be regarded as of Negroid stock, although no Negro language has held its ground either there or anywhere beyond the proper, the Negro domain proper. This is the more surprising that in some parts of America, notably in the West Indian Islands, the colored has actually replaced the indigenous and largely absorbed the white element. Here we are altogether on firmer ground, and fairly accurate returns enable us to form an approximate estimate of the proportion of full blood and half-caste Negroes in almost every part of the New World. On the other hand, the nomenclature of these mongrels has become so perplexing and is often applied so irregularly that it has led to many misconceptions on this point. Imagine that, people being called mongrels in an objective scholarly article. Thus the term Creole, applicable, and this portion might be a little tedious because they are going to present the labels used to describe different types of half-breeds or mongrels in different parts of the Western Hemisphere, for the most part. And I believe it's useful to understand those labels the way they were used by 19th century scholars, so even though it might seem a little tedious, we're going to go through the list anyway. It's only about maybe 15 terms, 16 terms, I'm guessing, right? Could be 20. On the other hand, the nomenclature of these mongrels has become so perplexing and is often applied so irregularly that it has led to many misconceptions on this point. Thus the term Creole, applicable in Mexico only to persons of pure Spanish descent, denotes in Brazil, Peru, and elsewhere the presence of black blood in varying proportions. Of this bewildering nomenclature, the chief terms are as under: Negro, African, or Black, a full-blooded Negro, whether born in Africa or of African descent. Mulatto, the issue of black and white parents either way, a constant term in America. Mestizo, any half-breed, whether of white and Negro parents, or more commonly, in Spanish America, of white and Indian parents. And of course, that word mestizo is where the word Mexico comes from, because the whites, and especially the Jews there, readily interbred with native Indians at a very early time. Creole, mostly white of pure descent, but also blacks of pure descent in Brazil, or the issue of whites and mestizos in Peru, and mestizos generally in Alaska. I didn't know the term was used in Alaska, but there were Indians to mix with there as well. Zambo, Z-A-M-B-O. Any half-breed, but mostly the issue of Negro and Indian parents. In the United States, Peru, and West Indies, of Negro and Mulatto. In St. Vincent, the half-caste Caribs. Zambo Preto, the issue of Negro father and Zamba mother in Mexico and elsewhere. Cholo, the issue of Zambos. I guess a Cholo is like a third-generation bastard. Pardo, synonymous with mulatto in Brazil and mestizo in the Argentine states. Mamaluco is any mestizo, but especially the issue of whites and Indians in Brazil. Chino is a Negro and Indian half-caste in Mexico and generally in Spanish America. Casco is a direct issue of mulattoes on both sides. So you're not a mulatto if your parents are mulattoes, you're a casco in South America. Tente en el aire. I didn't look up what that translates to. Tint in the eye, maybe. I'm joking. Halfway. Mongrels in whom the white element predominates in South America. They had a special term for them. Tente en el aire. A-Y-R-E. Aire, perhaps. A cafuso is the issue of Negro and Indian, dark shade and woolly hair predominating in Brazil. A cabaret is the issue of a Negress and Indian in Brazil. And of course, Brazil is probably the world epicenter of race mixing. The Carabico, Tupanhuma, and Zibaro are local Brazilian terms of Tupi Indian origin, applied to various crosses between the Negroes and Indians. And the Quaternoon, Quinteroon, and Octoroon are Negro and white half-breeds, with fresh infusion of white blood each successive generation. Thus, Quaternoon has 1/4, Quinteroon 1/8, Octoroon 1/16 black blood only, the last being scarcely distinguishable from a white. Before the suppression of the slave trade, during the first half of the present century, the 19th century, from 60,000 to 70,000 Negroes were annually shipped to America, where their descendants of all shades now number altogether upwards of 12 millions. And they break this down. This is published in 1894. In the United States, the colored element, 6,580,000, the proportion to the whole population being 13%. In Mexico, 60,000. These are actual Negroes, the percentage being one half of 1% in Central America, 50,000, the proportion to the whole population being 1%. In the West Indies, 3.7 million, the percentage being 83%, and they had said that the white element virtually disappeared. In Brazil, 2 million, the percentage being 20%. In Haiti, the Africans have established their political autonomy, here forming two independent states with total population of 820,000. They probably refer to Haiti and the Dominican Republic, I would guess. The author does not inform us that this was accomplished during a mass butchering of whites by Negroes in 1804. Elsewhere, slavery has been everywhere abolished, except in Brazil, where it is rapidly becoming extinct. Hence, the whole of the colored population now constitutes a class of freedmen, in some places apparently dying out, as in Central America and the Argentine states, in some remaining stationary, as in Mexico and Peru, but in others increasing rapidly. This is especially the case in the United States, as shown by the subjoined returns for the whole of the present century. What they mean by that is a chart of the Negro population over the census periods every 20 years. And we're going to read the chart because it makes a point, a good point, that Negroes in America have always multiplied a lot more quickly than whites. In 1800, the colored element, they call it, was 1,002,000, and the proportion to the whole population was 19%. And even though the proportion shrinks, the Negroes are still growing more rapidly and multiplying more rapidly at that time, and that will be explained. In 1820, it was 1,772,000 and still 19%. In 1840, 2,874,000 and only 17%. In 1860, 4,442,000. So in 60 years, they quadrupled, more than quadrupled in number, and that being 14% of the whole population. In 1870, 4,880,000 and 13%, and in 1880, 6,580,000 and 13% of the whole population. It is obvious from this table that the Negroes, without any further importations from Africa, meaning that after 1860, there were no more Negroes being imported to America, yet their numbers went up from 1840 at 2.8 million to 1880 at 6.5 million, well more than double, a million more than double in 40 years. Without any further importations from Africa, the Negroes are increasing far more rapidly than the native whites, and that they would ultimately become the predominant element in the southern states, but for the constant stream of migration flowing from Europe to North America. In other words, the percentage of Negroes went down only because whites were constantly migrating into the Americas during that period, from Germany, from England, and from other places in Europe. Owing to this migration, they decreased relatively to the rest of the population from 1820 to 1860, but since then, they have maintained their relative proportion in spite of this migration, so they're multiplying a lot more quickly. Recently, they have themselves begun to move westwards at the rate of about 50,000 annually. Should the movement continue, an equilibrium may be established, because the rate of mortality gains on a birth rate, according as they move farther away from the hot southern states, where alone the race can expect to establish itself in the Republic. Of course, that was true in 1894, but it's not true with the advances we have had in technology since then. Now we have heating as well as air conditioning. We have oil furnaces and gas furnaces, and electric heating are basically ubiquitous. They're all over the place. Everybody has it. So Negroes can now live anywhere, just as whites can live in the hot climates with the advent of air conditioning. The author of this Britannica article was Augustus Henry Keene, an Irish Catholic journalist, linguist, geographer, and ethnologist who studied in Germany and taught in Germany and in England. Leaving London in 1885, he spent a period of time lecturing on ethnology at, of all places, the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, a place which could certainly use his lectures today. Wikipedia mentions this very article in its own brief article on Augustus Keene, where it is evident that Wikipedia also misrepresents the character and scope of Keene's ethnological views in what is apparently a weak attempt to discredit this particular article on the Negro. The Wikipedia article admits that Keene wrote articles for Encyclopedia Britannica, and then says that those articles included Negro in the 9th edition, which included details of the racial theory of Filippo Mannetta. This too is a misrepresentation, as this article on a Negro included the findings of dozens of academic works in the field, and not only those of Mannetta. In its bibliography, it also credited Dr. John Van Every, and the book, from the very book from which we had read the preface at the beginning of our presentation this evening. The bibliography from Pruner Bay, and I'll read just English titles because a lot of them are in French and Italian and German. From Pruner Bay, the Memoir of the Negroes, published in Paris in 1861. From Winwood Reed, Savage Africa. From Carl Vogt, Lectures on Man. From Filippo Mannetta, The Black Race in its Savage State and in its Dual Status of Emancipated and Slave, published at Turin in Italy in 1864. From John Campbell, Negromania, published in Philadelphia in 1851. We will definitely be taking a close look at that book. From J.F. Blumenbach, On the Natural Varieties of Mankind, published in Göttingen in 1775. Lawrence, Physiology, Zoology, and the History of Man, published in 1819. Dr. Paul Broca, Memoirs, published in the Bulletin for the Bulletin of the Society of Anthropology from 1860 through 1878. From Dr. Van Every, On Negroes and Negro Slavery. From Bram, Travel Sketches from Northeast Africa. From Colonel Hamilton Smith, Natural History of the Human Species, Edinburgh, 1848. From Hutchinson, Wanderings in West Africa. From George McHenry, The Cotton Trade and Negro Slavery, published in London in 1863. From S.G. Morton, Crania Egyptica. Craniums of Egypt, right? From Peter Brown, Classification of Mankind by the Hair and Wool of Their Heads. From Knott and Gleeden, Indigenous Races of the Earth, published in Philadelphia, 1857. From Wilson, Ethnographic View of West Africa, published in New York, 1856. From Pritchard, James Cowles Pritchard, Natural History of Man, published in London in 1855. From Latham, Varieties of Man, published in London, 1850. From E.B. Taylor, Anthropology, London, 1881. From Pickering, Races of Man, London, 1850. From R.N. Cust, A Sketch of the Modern Languages of Africa, London, 1883. From F.L. James, The Wild Tribes of the Sudan, published in London, 1883. They also included in their bibliography the writings of the travelers Leo Africanus, Bruce, Mungo Park, Denham, Clapperton, Lander, Burkhart, Barth, Richardson, Nachtigall, Schweinfurth, Baker, Junker, Beltrami for Sudan and the Nile Basin, and of Croft, Duchelieu, Burton, Speke, and Grant, Livingstone, Magyar, Cameron, Fritz Bleek, Lentz, Poga, Wissmann, Schuver, Holub, Moore, Buckner, and Gusfeld for Equatorial and South Africa. And after the bibliography, we see the inscription A.H.K. for Augustus H. Keene. The article for Negro, found in the later 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, published in 1911, had retained much of the language and many of the conclusions which we have seen here in this article, and even the citations from Filippo Manetta, for which Wikipedia criticizes Keene. That later article was written in part by Walter Francis Wilcox, who had a Master of Arts degree, and then a Bachelor of Laws degree, and also a PhD, and who was at one time the chief statistician for the United States Census Bureau and a professor of social science and statistics at Cornell University. One paper by Wilcox was a report titled Negroes in the United States for the Census Bureau, which was published by the government in 1904. Another and earlier paper was Negro Criminality, which was delivered as an address to the Social Science Association at Saratoga, New York, in 1899. It is no surprise that the 1911 Britannica article by Wilcox on the Negro, which retained many of the conclusions of Keene, also expanded on this aspect of Negro behavior. The main body of the article was written by British anthropologist Thomas Athol Joyce, and the Wikipedia article for Wilcox only states that the Britannica article, the 1911 Britannica article on the Negro, is of interest today for the insight it gives into racial prejudices of the time. What a load of bullshit that is. Speaking of Keene, a non-scientist who wrote of scientific conclusions, Wikipedia described him as being out of step with the anthropology of the time. Then, speaking of Van Evry, whom Keene had cited, and who was a doctor sharing those same conclusions, Wikipedia had said that he lacked significant scientific evidence for his views. But then, where professional and scientific men such as Wilcox and Joyce also shared the very same conclusions, Wikipedia dismisses scientific findings as mere racial prejudices of the time. If any of the conclusions from our sources this evening are lacking scientific evidence, are out of step, and should be offhandedly dismissed as prejudices, it is those of Wikipedia, which are patently and even blatantly dishonest. We hope to discuss Wilcox and Thomas Athol Joyce, and the later 1911 Britannica article on the Negro in the near future. And in that manner, we hope to continue this examination on academic attitudes towards the Negro in the 19th and early 20th centuries. We also hope to be able to investigate just why and how such objective and demonstrably valid scientific assessments of the Negro character suddenly began to change, and how those who came to such conclusions, based on sound scientific evidence, have even suffered ridicule for so doing in the ensuing decades. Thank you for listening. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and good night.